This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
You bitch!
How bad it gets.
Sally, I think I'll buy the flowers myself.
But you're not a girl, you're a guy. And why would a guy want to marry a guy?
Don't stomp your little lassies of Prada, she's a me, honey.
John Callio, will you go around with me?
Don't fuck with me, fellas!
Oh, I feel so damn sick and dirty, I can't stand it anymore.
I wish I knew how to quit you.
Is butter a curve?
I had a hunch he might be a real romantic.
We were decoys. He used us as bait. We procured for him.
We could have had a good life together. Fucking real good life. But you ain't wanted in us. So what we got now is broke right now.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where tonight we are celebrating the theatrical screening of Josh Howard's The Lavender Scare by turning our attention to queer-leaning films that explore the themes of fear and persecution against the backdrop of the mid-20th century. So, Conrad, a light evening.
Yes. Something that we can just breeze through, I thought.
No, look, the films that we're looking at tonight, we've curated, I think, a really strong selection of films that take us back to that period in time, the mid-20th century, particularly the US and also the UK, and films that explore these themes of fear and persecution. So films like Tom Ford's A Single Man.
Victim.
The classic. 1960. It is a classic. Mm. It was the first film, the first UK film to ever have the word homosexual actually expressly said in it. So a huge film, really. Yeah. And the kind of classification issues around the film really do highlight how controversial the film it actually was. And so do all of the reviews that the film kind of engendered. Mm. But of course, we're also looking in depth at Josh Howard's The Lavender Scare, which is screening this month as part of Queer Screen Film Fest up in Sydney.
Right.
Really great selection of films showing at the festival this year. I think one of the great things about living in Australia is that we do have so many film festivals. It feels just as soon as one film festival ends, the next one begins.
You know, and I just missed the main one in Melbourne, so anywhere I can catch these films afterwards or at another festival, I appreciate.
All you need to do is listen to the Outtakes podcast.
Which I do.
Which you do.
Religiously.
It's as though you were there at the festival with us.
Yes.
So, look, as we said, we're looking at films that explore these ideas of fear and persecution as they pertain to the queer community in the middle of the 20th century. And I think a really good film to start with is A Single Man, which does take us back to that time. It's obviously based on the Christopher Isherwood novel of the same name, who we know wrote Berlin Stories that Cabaret is based on, and a number of other texts that really deal with themes of fear and persecution, but also isolation. Mm. So A Single Man, this is about a single man. You know, he feels single and solitary and isolated from the broader community. And we do get a sense that it is because of the fear and the persecution that is kind of facilitated by this society that he's positioned in.
And it's that constant through his whole story is how is he going to present himself, or who is he going to be for whoever he is talking to or, you know, entertaining, I guess. And it dips in and out of that all through his film.
What's great about the film is that it takes place over the course of just one day, but you really do get this kind of sense of, as you say, him kind of dipping trying to... I guess the film starts, we learn that he's recently lost his life partner, but it is also set in the Cuban Missile Crisis. So what I love about the film is that it makes the personal very political. And we really do get a sense that this is Colin Firth's character, George, trying to come to terms with himself. But we also get a sense that this is just a microcosm of a society trying to come to terms with itself.
Absolutely.
And one of the things that's obviously affecting how that society comes to terms with itself and how George comes to terms with itself is the way that other people think of it, and indeed the way that other people think of George. And you do get that sense in this wonderful scene that we have toward the beginning of the production, which is where... we're introduced to Kenny, who plays a kind of quasi-love interest in the film, a young fellow played by Nicholas Holt, who also appears in another film that we'll be touching on later in the program. But it's in this scene that Colin Firth so eloquently lays out some of the themes that are really crucial to this story, one of which is fear.
Sir, on page 79, Mr. Proctor says that the stupidest text in the Bible is "they hated me without a cause." Does that mean the Nazis were right to hate the Jews? Is Huxley an anti-Semite?
No, Mr. Huxley is not an anti-Semite. Of course, the Nazis were wrong to hate the Jews, but their hating the Jews was not without a cause. It's just that the cause wasn't real. The cause was imagined. The cause was fear. Let's leave the Jews out of this just for a moment. Let's think of another minority, one that can go unnoticed if it needs to. There are all sorts of minorities. Blondes, for example. People with freckles. The minority is only thought of as one when it constitutes some kind of threat to the majority, a real threat or an imagined one. And therein lies the fear. And if that minority is somehow invisible, then the fear is much greater. And that fear is why the minority is persecuted. And so you see, there always is a cause. The cause is fear. Minorities are just people. People like us.
I think that's such a perfect clip for what we're talking about tonight. And one of the things about this film as well is that it's really fondly remembered in lots of ways because it was so stylish. You know, Tom Ford brought such a beautifully beautiful look to this film, and it kind of really leaped off the screen for so many people. But the story itself, I think sometimes when people refer back to this may forget that it was actually quite tragic and quite a... you know, a tale of persecution and fear of letting yourself out there, which was such a... It was very well balanced with the casting and the way it was told. But underlying it all is that really solid story of sadness.
I think it is a tragic story. And I have to say, the book itself is really actually short. Some people call it a novella. And and if you think the film is tragic, the book is tragic. The book is hard to get through, so rewarding. It's excellent. I think it's his best work. But the other thing that I just want to pick up on something that you said, and that's the production, because this is a beautiful film. It's stylish and it's extravagant. And the production design was actually done by the same team that did Mad Men, interestingly enough.
Of course.
Which makes sense.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know that scene where George, Colin Firth, gets a call from the brother of his lover informing him that he's died?
Oh, yeah.
That's John Hamm. That's John Hamm's voice, which, so, you know, it all kind of comes together. But the other really interesting thing about the production design in this is that it reminds me of a film like Far From Heaven, the Todd Haynes film, that's set in a similar period with Julianne Moore and Dennis Quaid, because that is a film that really interrogates this kind of artificial world where everything is stylish and everything is beautiful, and really invites us to kind of see beyond that.
So true.
And if we have time, you know, we might look at that film in a little bit more depth later in the program. But I think what both of these films are doing is taking us to a period in time where, so they're suggesting, there was more style than substance. And that style was, for a lot of people, very truncating.
Yeah. And the sad thing is that we know that there's just so many stories from that period that translate into this theme, which is kind of leads to the sadness of it all as well.
And one story that hasn't been told very much on screen, in fact, I don't know that it's ever been told before the Lavender Scare, is this idea of persecution within the government. So the Lavender Scare chronicles this kind of decades-long persecution of homosexuals who were kind of weeded out and purged from government ranks. And it's scary because it feels very reminiscent of what we're seeing in America and to some extent in Australia now.
Yeah. So there's something about the idea of being investigated and being judged on all these things so with no real context or evidence other than we think you are or this person thought you might be, to lose your whole career. And in some cases, you know, for some people, ruin their whole lives.
Based on nothing more than a fear of the word homosexual.
Absolutely.
So it's tragic, and I think it's so important that we're seeing it finally on the big screen in Josh Howard's new documentary, The Lavender Scare, which is, of course, screening at the Queer Screen Film Fest this month. So we'll be speaking with Josh Howard, the director of The Lavender Scare, right after this.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening we're turning our attention back to the mid-20th century and films about that period of time, or films made about that period of time, dealing with the themes of fear and persecution. So not a very light topic for this evening, Conrad, but these are excellent films that we're exploring.
I was going to say, it's kind of the juxtaposition of the sad and terrible topic is that there's some really great stories and films that have come out of it.
And we've just looked at A Single Man, which I think really excellently explores these ideas against the backdrop of the mid-20th century and this time where America, like politics in America, were spiraling almost out of control. And that's what The Lavender Scare really deals with. So The Lavender Scare is the new documentary from Josh Howard. It's based on David K. Johnson's 2004 book of the same name, which kind of studied this period in time. And actually, I think, came up with the phrase The Lavender Scare, which refers loosely to a witch hunt and the mass kind of firings of gay people in the 1950s from the United States government, and kind of paralleled the anti-communist campaign known as McCarthyism and the Second Red Scare.
And I think the thing about this film that will surprise a lot of people is the length that it went on for. We're talking over 40 years, but also the impact it had on so many people. And I think that's what the documentary does very well, is obviously there's the impact it has on the person who is, you know, basically hounded out of their job for no real reasons, and in a lot of cases no evidence based on it. But the impact it had on so many other people's lives, the butterfly effect from what happened to them. And also, I think the part of it that was really fascinating to me was the interviews with the people who actually investigated the gay employees to actually get rid of them. And in some cases, they're kind of, it was just my job. And
I was really surprised by that, actually. I was surprised that these people were happy to have their faces on the screen as the kind of figurehead of this movement that purged the government of homosexuals. It was just a bit strange, really. But I also agree that what was really effective about this documentary was the kind of face that they put to this kind of persecution. It really did give it a very human kind of touch, a very human element.
And they managed to focus on quite a few different people's stories without it being too overwhelming. But each one was unique because you could kind of see perhaps people that you know or understand where that what they were doing in their lives and their contribution to the government and to the community to just be wiped away because of some stupid, you know, witch hunt that had actually nothing to do with what they were delivering in their job. And just, I think that he did a very good job at capturing all of the tragedy And the ridiculousness of it?
Yeah, I think...
sounding trite?
No, but the ridiculousness, I do feel like he captured that, especially when he or the documentary started to explore what it was that prompted authorities to investigate particular people. So they would be tipped off by randoms who would say, this person doesn't wear a lot of lipstick, therefore she must be gay.
Yes.
Or this person wears power suits, therefore she must be gay.
He has an effeminate walk.
And a jelly handshake,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, jelly handshake.
So, and this actually was enough information for the authorities to investigate people. Mm. Not only investigate them, but this is a part that was particularly cruel. Say to them, we know that you're a homosexual at a time where same-sex intimacies were illegal. And say to them, you know, we can imprison you, or you can give us the name of, say, five other homosexuals working for the department. If you do that, we'll let you go. And that kind of blackmailing, which also comes up in Victim, the 1961 film that we'll look at later in the evening, but it's shocking, really.
And it's a tried and true method of getting people to turn on each other.
Yeah.
You know, making them so scared of what could happen to them that if you turn on other people, we may be treat you better. I mean, the shocking thing for me was just recently after seeing the impact of that same technique that the Nazis used and seeing that documented in Berlin and where they, a lot of the times, were using Jewish people to, you know, root out other Jewish people and to basically, you know, set them up to either be murdered or imprisoned or whatever. And that America played such a big part in you know, finishing that and stopping that from happening and rebuilding that country after World War II, yet they adopted it, you know, 10 years later as a way to persecute another group of people.
Right.
It's just really, really fascinating that nothing was learned from that experience.
The other really fascinating thing in a similar vein is this assertion that the documentary makes, or that a number of people being interviewed in the documentary make, that most people, quote unquote, would not actually bend or dob in their colleagues, but for some reason homosexuals did.
Yes.
That's the claim that the documentary makes.
Right.
And I think the documentary is vested in making that claim. Whether or not it's true, I don't know.
Sure.
But I think that's interesting to think about. If it is true, why was that the case? Mm. Is it because the law really did play such a crucial role in robbing these people of their dignity and self-respect? Or, you know, is there something more sinister at play? I don't know, but I think it's interesting to think about, and I think it's an interesting point that the documentary explores.
There's two parts of this that I think a lot of people will be really surprised about, is the fact that it went on for over 40 years.
Yeah, right.
And the other part that really played with my mind was how he spoke to the fact that they had no actual evidence based to actually roll this campaign out. There was never any indication that any queer person had given up secrets or, you know, was being used as a spy or whatever. But the actual persecution of this community and just using it as a way to bully and go after this group of people was enough for everyone to just get on board.
There was no evidence.
Yeah.
And one of the claims that the documentary makes is that there is no evidence and that there wasn't one person who was actually linked to being a spy for the then Soviet Union.
Mm.
But again, you know, you brought up Berlin and this comparison with the Jewish minority during the Second World War. And that's actually a comparison that's explored in another film that we'll be looking at later this evening.
Yes.
But, I mean, I think there is a really interesting comparison there.
Mm. And I think this film, you can tell that the research that was done for the book really added a lot of weight to it in terms of using recordings from some of the interviews that were done. The most powerful one, I think, was a recording with one of the investigators who was extremely honest. And he, I think one of the things that just really jolted me was he just laughed about it all, you know.
Yeah.
He was like, yeah, we'd go in there and we'd get them, and, you know, and then sometimes, oh, they'd do silly things like, you know, kill themselves. And it was just such an interesting way for you to really understand just how pointless it all was.
Well, the documentary, there's no doubt that it's important. Mm. I sat down with Josh Howard, the director of this documentary. This is part one of our chat. Now, perhaps to begin, the documentary opens up in the mid-50s when President Eisenhower has just told Congress about his efforts to purge the government of homosexuals. So this is a really interesting time in American history that we haven't really seen delved into by a documentary or indeed by any kind of film. Why do you think we haven't seen this on our screens yet, and why was it so important for you to bring it to our screens?
Very little is known about this period and this aspect of gay history and American history, because at the time it was going on, it wasn't in anybody's interest to talk about it. The gay people who were being fired at the time didn't want to discuss why they had been fired by the federal government, because they needed to find other jobs, and having been fired by the government was not going to be helpful to them. And so it became kind of this hidden process that was going on. And this policy remained in effect for 4 decades. The firings continued, but no one really paid any attention to it or wanted to speak about it. So it's really an unknown chapter of our history.
And one of the really interesting components of the documentary is the way it charts the kind of rise in the political climate to that point where this policy decision was made to kind of weed out any homosexuals from government. And I think that the documentary does a really, really fantastic job of showing how the political climate, the very particular political climate, kind of combined with a kind of rise in research about sexuality, so sexuality studies and things of that sort, to create this atmosphere where this purge was inevitable. It's so reminiscent of our current political climate.
Well, I think it's there's an important message there. And, you know, it's taken us quite some time to get this project finished. We've been working on it for several years. And I couldn't have imagined that it would seem as relevant to current events as it actually does right now. The homophobia of the 1950s, in many ways, was a direct backlash against a period that came before, in which homosexuality was much more widely accepted during the 1920s and 30s and 40s, not just in the United States, but to some degree around the world. Mm. And there was this real backlash then in the 1950s. And I think there's an important message for us today. Yeah, we've had we've made some great progress over the past years, but I think it's important to remember that social progress doesn't necessarily continue in a direct line. There can be a step back for every couple of steps forward, and it's important to be vigilant about the progress that we have made.
I think one of the more pertinent kind of comparisons is the situation in the United States in relation to trans people serving in the military. Watching this documentary and the way that homosexuals were ruthlessly kind of weeded out of government, I couldn't help but draw a comparison with the political situation relating to trans people serving in the army.
Yeah, there's the parallels are frightening, and that's one of the one of the lessons, I think, of the film. Right before leaving office, our last Secretary of State issued an apology on behalf of the U.S. government for what the government did to gay men and lesbians during the 1950s. Mm. And it was the first time that the government actually acknowledged that this policy had been in effect and then it was the wrong thing to do. 2 days after taking office, President Trump had any mention of that apology removed from the government website. And I think right from the start of his administration, it sent a message that these are going to be challenging times for us.
They've turned out to be exactly that. And I think actually just picking up on something that you mentioned a moment ago about the lessons of this documentary, the other really interesting lesson for me was how this kind of government policy in the 50s and 60s and indeed for a number of decades kind of served as a starting point for the way that other people treated and thought of homosexual people, particularly the police, but also the broader community who in no time at all started reporting various people in their offices who they thought were homosexuals.
Well, that's such a good point. It was really, beyond the huge number of people who were fired as a result of this policy, The damage done by the government goes far beyond people losing their jobs. The government's policy here really cemented in people's minds the idea that homosexuals were disloyal, untrustworthy, immoral, and for gay men and lesbians, that homophobia persisted for decades.
Why must I meet you in a secret rendezvous? Why must we steal away to steal a kiss or two? Why must we wait to do the things we want to do?
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening we're travelling back in time to the middle of the 20th century and exploring films from that time or films made about that time that deal with themes of fear and persecution, which it's heavy stuff, but you know what? It's really relevant to today.
I know. It's like, for better or worse. Yeah. And like I said before, there's just, the sad thing is that there is just so many stories around this theme from that time. But in a lot of ways, it's a really good way for us to acknowledge this period and all these horrible things that did happen to people and hopefully learn something from it.
Yeah, and I think one of the, on that note of kind of learning, one of the really interesting things that we were discussing with Josh earlier in the program was this idea that the law really did license everyday people to discriminate against homosexual people. And I feel like that's something that's really pertinent to our situation here in Australia right now, obviously with our clamoring to change the law in relation to marriage, but also in America with some of the stuff that's happening, say, for instance, in relation to trans people in the military. And I feel like what's happening to trans people in the military is very similar to what happened to homosexuals 60 years ago in the US, which is for no real reason, they're being kind of cut out from the ranks of government service.
I think this documentary did a really interesting exploration too into who McCarthy was and talking about him. And there's one part where one of the senators that's referring to McCarthy is like, yeah, he's really good at just making things up on the fly, making it sound really important and making it sound like fact and then putting it out there. And that kind of
reminds you of someone.
Sounds like, President 45. But he also, it's that really interesting thing. It does feel like the queer community over the years is always the go-to to distract people from the real issues.
Yeah.
So it's, buy into this thing of, you know, trans people are scary, marriage equality is going to ruin the world, all of those sorts of things. And it's like the real problems are all there, but it's easy to distract people with this silliness.
This is why your comparison earlier in the program to Nazi Germany is very pertinent, because in times of crisis, and, you know, there were crises back then. In times of crisis, minority groups are persecuted. They are scapegoated. And that's what happened here. So I did ask Josh, the director of this documentary, The Lavender Scare, I asked Josh, you know, what he thought about the law acting as this kind of tool that enabled people within the community to then discriminate. And this is what Josh had to say.
Well, it's exactly right. It's really the government empowering people to engage in discrimination, because it sends the message that it's not only all right to do it, but you should be discriminating. And it's really part of the damage that this policy did.
The other really interesting component that you deal with in The Lavender Scare is this idea that gay people who were confronted by the authorities in relation to their employment were very willing to bend to that authority. You have one interviewee who says where other people would have stood up for their rights, homosexuals just didn't. Was that the case? And if so, why do you think that was the case?
Well, to a large degree, it was the case. And that's one of the ironies of the whole story. The theory of why homosexuals were a security threat was that foreign agents were going to blackmail them into giving up government secrets. And there was never a single example of that actually happening. But what was interesting was our own government was indeed blackmailing gay men and lesbians into turning in, you know, their friends and providing, you know, further, you know, leads on investigations.
The really interesting thing is the kind of signifiers that people were using when they were dobbing other people in, essentially. Things like this person wears a stern suit and this person has a jelly handshake and this person doesn't wear a lot of lipstick. And it was all a bit of a farce, really.
The government was sending out this message to people that, you know, gay men and lesbians are a danger and we need their names. And so what was happening was people would start, you know, turning in their, you know, coworkers or neighbors or people who they just happened to have a grudge against. And we were able to see some of these, some anonymous and some, you know, signed letters that people were sending into the, you know, the government agents, saying those kinds of ridiculous things that you just mentioned. You know, the kind of stereotypical, you know, that person must be gay because of, you know, whatever. And it does seem like a farce, and it does seem amusing, except the government was actually following up on all of those.
And speaking of things that are farcical, it does just strike me how farcical this kind of conflation of homosexuality with acting as a spy for the then Soviet Union or any other country in this particular political climate. It's just hard to fathom how that kind of conflation was seen as legitimate.
Well, but it's also an example of how, you know, in times of concern over national security, you know, any minority group can be demonized.
Right.
You know, we really don't know if anybody really believed that gay people were going to be blackmailed, but it was a very potent political weapon that one party was able to use against another.
I was just going to say, if we're talking about lessons that this documentary can teach us, that is one of the great lessons of this documentary, that in times of crisis, minority groups will be scapegoated and will be demonized. And it feels like that is what's been happening very recently in the United States as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, sadly, there's a history of this in the United States. During World War I, Germans were targeted and deported. During the Great Depression, Mexicans were deported because it was believed that they were responsible for the economic downturn. Certainly during World War II, Japanese Americans were rounded up. We have a history of this. And, you know, particularly at this moment in time, I think it's important to be aware of it and remember it and, you know, keep in mind that, you know, those witch hunts turned out to be, you know, not the right thing to do.
Well, that was our interview with Josh Howard. Josh is the director of The Lavender Scare, which is screening at the Queer Screen Film Fest this month, later this month. So if you're interested in The Lavender Scare, and it is a really important documentary, head to queerscreen.org.au where you can find out more about the film and about its screening as part of the festival.
And hopefully it makes its way around into all other festivals.
Well, we could
festivals.
Be seeing it at MQFF next year. Who knows?
Would be a good one.
You're listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening we are exploring films about fear and persecution. And if you can't tell, this is a very famous track from X-Men. This is from the cartoon version, but we're playing it now because we're turning our attention to X-Men First Class, which was the prequel to the trilogy that we got in the late 90s, early noughties. And it takes us back to this period in time that we're looking at this evening, the early 60s, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, during this kind of political tension around the world, and deals with fear and persecution in relation to minorities, but also, I think, in relation to queer people.
It's kind of, it's one of those things too that I think some people were like, X-Men? But if, you know, you dig deep into them and if you've watched any of the films, their underlying theme is always there, particularly when it comes to how the characters are treated in the broader community, particularly as a minority.
Well, Conrad, you made the comparison with Nazi Germany earlier in the program, and that's exactly where this film starts. So, I mean, the film is making that comparison too, isn't it?
I'm not saying my thought was original, but yes, it worked in well.
Yeah, and I think what this X-Men film does, and indeed most of the X-Men films do, is that they, well, obviously they deal with kind of war and fighting and battle and this kind of one side versus the other side, but it's real, like, you do get a sense that the good guys are the queer community in many ways. These are people who are born differently to everyone else, and because they're born differently, they're persecuted and they're isolated, and they have to kind of bond together in this quasi-family to survive, and that's what they do, and that's what the films are about.
Their whole stories and a lot of the motivation for the character is all born and buried into their identity, which is, yeah, I mean, the comparisons are easy. I'm assuming, too, that the director, being an openly gay man for a lot of these films, I think probably brought that sensibility to it more so than anyone else would have, perhaps.
Very possibly. The interesting thing is that X-Men First Class, which is actually the film set in the 60s, is one of the only films that he didn't direct.
Oh, didn't he? It's one of the good ones.
He produced it. Right. He did produce it. So X-Men First Class is set primarily in 1962 during the missile crisis. It focuses on the kind of young relationship between Charles Xavier, played by James McAvoy, and Magneto, played by Michael Fassbender, and tells the kind of origin of their groups, the X-Men on one hand and the Brotherhood of Mutants on the other, as they kind of deal with the Hellfire Club, led by Sebastian Shaw, who's the villain in this film, played by Kevin Bacon. And, I mean, you do get a sense, particularly from Kevin Bacon, of the kind of war that's being pitted against mutants versus kind of quote-unquote normal humans. And that does kind of resonate with us as queer audiences, I think.
Good evening. My name is Sebastian Shaw. And I am not here to hurt you. Friends, there's a revolution coming when mankind discovers who we are, what we can do. Each of us will face a choice. The enslaved or rise up to rule.
Choose freely, but know that if you are not with us, then by definition, you are against us. So, you can stay, fight for the people who hate and fear you, or you can join me and live like kings.
Camp.
Yeah.
Just when you started playing that, I was like, oh, this is the one that starts off so quite serious,
yeah,
and very heavy, and then it ends up on a boat and January Jones is in a bikini. Kevin Bacon's making these big speeches about, you know, everything. Yeah.
And it's the one that brought back the original costumes, which they weren't camp enough to use in the original three,
right,
but by the time that this film came out, they were. So look, if there was any doubt that this is actually a really queer text, Ian McKellen, who is so eloquent, when he was doing press coverage for Days of Future Past, which was the X-Men film that followed this one,
right,
he kind of talked a little bit about the queer subtext of these films, and this is what Ian McKellen had to say.
In the case of X-Men, at the heart of it, there's a story of desperate human concern, which is, what does society do with its minorities? And mutants are a minority. They have special inborn gifts. They are peculiar, they're odd, they're different. But does that mean that they should be treated differently or harshly or destroyed? If you belong to a member of a minority of whatever sort, because of your race or your age or your sexuality or your the country that you come from, then these stories take on an immediacy which is nothing to do with special effects at all. Bryan Singer, when he asked me to play Magneto, was very clear about it. He said, you're a gay man, Ian. You know what it's like for society to point the finger at you and to pass laws which inhibit your behaviour and your happiness. That's exactly what is at the heart of X-Men. And Marvel, who published the comics on which they're based, agree. So we're not doing anything seditious or round the corner. That's what X-Men is, and I think that explains perhaps why they are so popular. It's not just entertainment, it's not just special effects, it's not just spectacle, it's not just taking you out of the world, it's actually about the real world.
That was Ian McKellen, who played Magneto in the X-Men franchise before Michael Fassbender was brought in, talking about the queer subtext in these X-Men films, and particularly in X-Men First Class, which is the film that we've been looking at tonight. And I do feel like what he had to say in relation to kind of laws inhibiting happiness and that kind of being a theme that X-Men explores is very relevant, clearly relevant to the Lavender Scare, which we've been looking at this evening, the new documentary from Josh Howard, but also very relevant to a film that we're going to look at in just one moment. The film is Victim, and this is a film that I think as much, if not more than any queer film, has really had a lot to say about the state of laws in relation to homosexuals. That's coming up in just a moment. You're listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening we've been looking at films set in the middle of the 20th century that kind of chart themes of fear and persecution. We've looked at the new documentary from Josh Howard, The Lavender Scare, and we've also looked at narrative films like A Single Man, X-Men First Class, and now we're turning our attention to a really kind of canonical queer film. The film is Victim. It's the 1961 British suspense drama directed by Basil Dearden and starring, of all people, Dirk Bogarde, whose filmography is a little bit...
it's really interesting.
It's interesting, isn't it?
I was saying to you before, he's kind of got this... apparently he started out as a matinee idol and then branched off into art house cinema and then became a journalist and an author. But this film in particular, from being 1961 and being, you know, a mainstream actor who was quite well known, would have been considered, and by some, a really brave choice, I'm sure by his agent, a really crazy choice.
Well, I think it's all the more interesting because you were telling me before that there's a lot of suspicion about his sexuality and it's something that was talked a lot about. So for someone who has that kind of suspicion circulating around them at this time to then go and play a queer character... was pretty brave, although there were some things said about his character. So the film is notable because it's really the first English film to have the word homosexual expressly said in it. But it's really notable because it deals with these themes of the law and the problems with the law. So a lot of people at the time said this is a really positive portrayal of homosexuals. You're portraying homosexuals as people who are not perverts and who don't need to be persecuted by the law. And at the time, the American Classification Board had a real problem with this because obviously the Hays Production Code, which we've talked a bit about on the program before, prohibited homosexual intimacy is being shown on the screen. And indeed, I think one of the first times it had been expressly shown was Suddenly Last Summer,
right,
which we've also looked at, but that had a very different kind of trajectory and was a lot more severe in its portrayal of homosexuality.
And this film, I think, was 7 years later, they repealed, there was an act.
Yeah, so that was the English law that prohibited same-sex sexual relations. The law was...
Sorry, I should have had my notes in front of me as well.
The Wolfenden... Oh, that was the report which had suggested that laws should change. The Sexual Offences Act, that's it, 1967.
And I think... thank you for finding that. I think, you know, a lot of people mentioned that this film played a big part in that... change of that happening, and I think that is the power of telling these stories. And you know, when we were talking before about Far From Heaven and other films like The Lavender Scare, they shine a light on these terrible stories and this terrible, you know, times that have happened and things that have happened to our community, which is only a positive thing really for us to remember, you know, what's happened before us and make sure it never happens again.
Yeah, and the great thing about this film is that it was actually made during that time. So obviously From Heaven is recollecting this time. Mm. A Single Man is recollecting this time. But this film was made at that time and really was pivotal in actually bringing about social change.
Especially with what was coming, you know, down the line with all the upheaval of the 60s, which again, The Lavender Scare kind of touches on. Mm. That change was brewing, but I mean, 1961, it, you know, it was before it was even really... taking off, so it was really a brave film to put out.
It was, but I need to temper my enthusiasm just a little bit because I do feel like this film is called Victim, and I feel like homosexuals are portrayed as victims
of course,
the film, and so that kind of representation is not really helpful when you're trying to establish that homosexual are legitimate people.
Yes,
that kind of representation is harmful, but certainly there's no question it was more positive than representation we'd seen until that point.
Absolutely, and it's a trope that's been used time and time again in telling our stories. There's always, you know, the sad part is that, you know, all of these things happened and then, you know, tragedy kind of thing. So we've come a long way.
But when you do position a film like Victim alongside a film like Suddenly Last Summer, which was the comparison that the American Classification Board made, there is a clear difference, even though there are questions about representation and harmful representation and stigmatization. There's no doubt that this has a much more positive trajectory. Mm. And really, the character that Dirk Bogarde plays is a strong character. He takes on the justice system. I think it's a lot more hopeful than a film like Suddenly Last Summer.
Absolutely. And I think that other part of the film that was really interesting, that probably was what made it safe in a way, was that they had a romantic relationship that wasn't physical.
With a female. Right? Oh, they did.
Yes.
But he also had a romantic relationship with a female. So
there was a safety net there as well for that kind of time, although it's still pretty risque they were putting out there.
We can forgive it for the time that it was made. To have these kind of safety nets, you know, is understandable. Certainly this did a lot to foster better representation of queer people and to change the law as well. So actually, to finish up tonight's episode of Outtakes, we might finish by revisiting the original theatrical trailer for this now canonical piece of queer cinema. So this is the original trailer. That's it for another episode of Outtakes. To finish out the episode, here's the original theatrical trailer from the 1961 Basil Dearden thriller, Victim.
Barrett, if I hear from you again, I shall inform the police. Do you understand? That's absolutely final.
What thread of strange emotion puts this brilliantly successful barrister on the wrong side of the law?
if you dig this over, it could end in one hell of a scandal. And it wouldn't only be you who came down.
Fear is the oxygen of blackmail. Barrett was paying, others are. Find me one.
What crime links him with this frightened boy on a building site? And why is he afraid? Why do some people help him? Some people turn away in disgust.
Why can't he stick with his own sort? You can come home, Frank Jeffries, when you've got rid of him.
What sinister shadow from the past now falls between husband and wife?
When we were married. Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.